This is the River Radius, a cultural nexus of rivers, people, and boats. I am your host, Sam Carter. Welcome.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's been some recent polling and message research looking at what people think about clean water. And not surprising, clean water is consistently polls as like the top environmental issue. People really, like, they rank clean water as number one, like, I really care about it, which is great, right? So good. And at the same time, people really care about clean water, they don't think that their own water is at risk. So they don't think they don't think clean water is a problem where they live, whether it's in their local streams or their drinking water or whatever. So that's really interesting.
Today's episode comes to you from the stories of 10 rivers that are ripe for extra support from us as the river community. Each year, for the past 39 years, American Rivers has developed a list of these 10 rivers, who is working on them, and what is needed. And for the third year in a row, the River Radius is giving mic space to these rivers. Our lead guest today is Amy Sowers-Kober from American Rivers. She will guide us through this list, offering a glimpse into these sweet rivers and their stories. And for three rivers from this list, we will talk directly with the people who are immensely familiar with that waterway and who are doing the work to care for that river. We will hear about the state of affairs of the rivers of New Mexico, the Duck River in Tennessee, and the Tijuana River in California and Mexico. To get us started, please welcome back to the River Radius, Amy Sowers-Kober and American Rivers.
My name is Amy Sowers-Kober, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I work at American Rivers. We're a national river conservation organization, and we believe that all life depends on rivers. And so I feel so incredibly fortunate to do what I do. I'm the vice president for communications and marketing. I feel like I have just the best job in the world because I get to work on rivers. I get to work with river people. I get to work with passionate people who really care about making the world a better place. I get to talk about rivers and tell stories about rivers and learn about water and all of the magic and awesomeness that comes with that. I love what I do.
And, you know, I think it's always good to ground the whole episode in the fact that we are river people. And I'm curious if you can talk about a river that you've been enjoying lately, if that's just like a place you go walking or a place you float or that you are working on.
So what immediately comes to mind when I think about a recent river in my life is the Grand Canyon, because I got to float. I got to do that trip with my mom, who just turned 80. And so it was just incredible to be in the Grand Canyon with my mom. She blew her mind. So special to share that with her. Yeah, it's hard to even find the words for what that meant at this point in her life to be able to do that. It just was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Good place to do it. So we're here today to talk about the most endangered rivers. This is a list that American Rivers puts out. And this is the third year that you've joined the River Radius. Last year, Samara interviewed you. The year before, I interviewed you. We're super glad to have you and talk through this each year. Can you tell us when the list started? What's the purpose of the list? Kind of some backstory on that you want to share.
Well, it's great to be here. You guys do such an awesome job. And we love you, your audience. So thank you for caring about rivers. So our America's Most Endangered Rivers report is in its 39th year. It's got a really solid history of raising awareness and of getting results. And I think there's a simplicity to it. I mean, everybody loves a top 10 list, right? Like, I think that's part of the appeal, maybe, or the reason why it's been successful for so long is because it's really clear what we're doing. And there's a lot of credibility. We solicit nominations from groups and individuals across the country every year. So it's not just us coming up with this list. We're asking the entire river movement, which rivers are endangered, right? Which rivers need urgent help right now? So we get all these nominations in and we filter through them. And we build the list based on three criteria. The first is the importance of the river to people and nature. The second is the magnitude of the threat. And the third is a decision point in the coming year that the public can influence. And that's important because a lot of rivers are generally in trouble, but there's not always an upcoming decision or an action that's going to determine the river's fate. So we want to choose rivers where people can actually do something about it. And that spotlight, that visibility we create with the media attention will spur decision makers to do the right thing. I really want to stress that this list, this report, this campaign, it's about opportunity. It's about solutions. It's really about, this is what the river needs. This is the value of the river to this community. Let's all stand up together and come together and make sure that this river can continue to be clean and healthy. And we want to set decision makers up for success. Let's all be river champions. Like, come on, like, do it. This is your opportunity to shine. We're ready to help, right? And so that spotlight is really powerful.
So today we're going to do it a little bit different. You and I are going to walk through the list of 10, but three of those, I have other interviews that are going to happen to talk about those. And that's for the Tijuana River, the Duck River, and then all rivers of New Mexico. And so those interviews are going to be mingled in here in the middle of the conversation. To get us going, though, let's go through the list. Can you start us either at 10 or 1? Let's start going through that list and talk about these briefly and learn about rivers.
The rivers of New Mexico, all of them, are in the number one spot. And that is because of the loss of federal clean water protections. So the Supreme Court last year gutted the Clean Water Act. It's a ruling called Sackett versus EPA. They slashed protections for small streams and wetlands. What this means for New Mexico is between like 90 and 96% of that state's streams and wetlands no longer have federal clean water protections. This is incredibly concerning, not just for the health of these streams, but for the people who depend on them, for agriculture, for businesses, for recreation, for fishing. So we're calling on the state to shore up state-level safeguards for streams in the short term. And of course, longer term, we are calling on Congress to strengthen the Clean Water Act. That absolutely needs to happen, not just for New Mexico, but for everywhere in this country. We need a stronger Clean Water Act.
That's come up a few times in other episodes, the Sackett versus EPA Supreme Court decision and how that is diminishing protections across the country. And so Rachel Kahn from Amigos Bravos out of New Mexico is going to join us a little later in the episode, and we'll talk more in-depthly about it, what it means for New Mexico to be at risk. So let's go on to number two on the list. What do you have for us?
Number two on the most endangered rivers list this year is the Big Sunflower and Yazoo Rivers in Mississippi. This is a repeat river. These rivers, these incredibly rich wetlands, incredibly rich ecosystem, threatened by the Yazoo Pumps drainage project. And this is a zombie project that kind of pops up and then gets killed and then pops up again. It's a massive pumping project, kind of sold under the guise of flood protection, but it would cause more harm than good. It would destroy thousands of acres of wetlands. We were just talking about how the Sackett case gutted protections for wetlands, right? So now we're talking about purposefully destroying more wetlands. Like we can't keep doing this in our country. We've got to protect these places. So we need to stop the Yazoo Pumps project. We need to follow the science, and we need to put in place flood protection solutions that work with nature, not against it.
I look at this picture in the list, and I wouldn't think it's a river just by looking. It more looks like a swamp, and it looks like a beautiful place, like a place would be really interesting to go canoe through. I'm curious, because this has been on the list before. There's another river that we're going to talk about, the Duck River, and the PD, these rivers in this like kind of southeast part of the United States, and there's just this really important wet zone between the Mississippi River and kind of like maybe Georgia, where there's so much water and there's so much, it's like a wetlands that we don't entirely understand. And I'm curious, is it a carbon sink, that kind of wetland zone?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something that's becoming kind of more and more appreciated when you think about the value of natural rivers and floodplains and wetlands to climate resilience. I mean, it's storing that carbon. It's also absorbing floodwaters, which are becoming more common with climate change. So tons of value in protecting these places.
Today's sponsor is Rocky Talkie. Sam, I'm on the river with these Rocky Talkie radios. I'm using the 5-watt. It is waterproof. We ran them through rapids yesterday and were able to communicate during and after the rapids. No problems. Perfectly clear communication. These are excellent for guide outfitters as well. The lead boat and the sweet boat can use these, and you can even have a radio on the bus to communicate with the bus. For outfitters, they're great where satellite phones are too cumbersome and maybe too expensive, and where cell phones don't work, but you just need simple communication with your bus. The discount code is RIVERRADIUS10, that's 10, RIVERRADIUS10, 10% off your entire order. You can find the web address and the discount code in our show notes, Rocky Talkie.
Our sponsor today is AED One Stop Shop. An AED is the automatic external defibrillator that is a great tool for commercial river outfitters to have on their boats. Have you heard our episode, Heart Attack on the River, from January of this year? That episode and story share the value and life-saving potential of having an AED on your commercial riverboats. AED One Stop Shop is working with the River Radius, providing a bulk order discount on their AED bundles right now that allows for complete deployment of AEDs throughout your river outfitting company. AED One Stop Shop has been working with river outfitters for 10 years. To gain their bulk discount, use the link in the show notes, on our website, or in our Instagram link tree to hit the landing page for AED One Stop Shop. Let's move on to number three. So this is one we're going to talk with the people directly on the landscape, on the riverscape. But would you just give us a real concise story here?
Sure. So the Duck River in Tennessee, the Duck River is the drinking water source for more than 250,000 people. It's one of the richest rivers for biodiversity, and it's threatened by excessive water withdrawals. So again, this is a case of an incredibly rich river, incredibly rich, valuable resource. And if we want it to remain this treasure of wildlife and clean drinking water, we've got to come into balance with our management.
And again, we'll talk with those people there at that river in another interview here soon in this episode. Let's go to number four. What do you got?
Number four on the list is the Santa Cruz River in Arizona. So this river has really been a symbol of restoration and resilience. There's been so much work done in Tucson to get water back in this river and bring it back to life. And that's all a fantastic success story, but it is increasingly threatened by water scarcity and climate change. And so this is really an important year to make sure that the trajectory of this river stays positive in terms of health, in terms of water. And we're also calling for the creation of an urban national wildlife refuge on the river to continue to help restore it and also really connect the community to this place. It's so important. I think in order for a river to really be healthy and protected, it needs that community connection. It needs people loving it. It needs people visiting it and talking about it and having it part of their lives and community. So we think that the creation of an urban wildlife refuge could really help do that.
And so the Santa Cruz River is coming out of various mountains in very deep southern Arizona, the Patagonia Mountains, and there's not a lot of water down there, though, in general. I'm reading that that water is kind of coming back into the river. What's happening there to bring water back into that river as opposed to taking it out?
There's been a lot of great work on groundwater infiltration and river restoration to make sure that this water can be flowing and that treated wastewater can be put back in the river, like in a healthy, clean way. Again, to like have a river, you need water in a river. And that really has created this like corridor of life that we want to keep protecting. And the story of drought in the Southwest and water management in the Southwest is a really huge story and very complicated and is going to keep going. We're doing a lot of work on that, and it's going to be for the rest of our lives that we're working on it. There are things we can do, positive steps we can take, like on an individual river like the Santa Cruz, establish a refuge for the river's health and for that community connection. Like, we need to do everything we can to keep connecting people with these places.
Okay, next one. The Little PD River, Little PD River, PEE and DEE. Tell us about this one, please.
Yeah, number five, the Little Petey in South Carolina. So gorgeous. Again, we're just, we've been talking about the Southeast US and this remarkable biodiversity and richness and these ecosystems and how unique and special they are. This is a river with great wetlands and wildlife habitat and forests, and it is threatened by a major highway project that would cut across all of these ecosystems and habitat and streams and really damage that habitat. And there's another route for this highway. And so we're not saying don't build the highway. We're saying choose the better route that is more sensitive to the river. And so we can continue having this healthy river and people can get where they need to go. And it's interesting, there are actually a few, I think three rivers on the list this year are threatened by some kind of road development, which isn't something that we kind of purposefully look for or are working on necessarily, but it is interesting that that popped up on a few of the rivers this year. That's an issue.
I have a lot of thoughts on that. When I was a kid, I remember loving driving over creeks and rivers because the bridges were built in such a way that you could see. It was kind of scary how much you could see, but my dad would always slow down and we'd look over. You could see right down to the water, and there's been a major change in the way bridges are built that we can't see down to the water very well. And I think it's a safety feature to make them like
That's
visually
true.
less distracting, but also these concrete metal barriers that protect cars from flying out. And I think that change in how we see the rivers, or in the lack of being able to see those, means that we don't recognize what's down there. So then I think of this highway that might get built here or these other places, and how people will appreciate a new roadway that's smooth, a little faster, but we won't recognize what the impact has been to the wildscape.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is let's just take a pause, like take a beat and consider all the costs and all the benefits, right? Like some like let's just have that public dialogue. What do we need? What do we want to protect? 99% of the time, like there's a path forward here, right? If we all just kind of take a pause and talk about and come together on a solution, like it's possible. It's absolutely possible. We can build a road. Maybe just don't cross all of these sensitive streams, right? Like there's other ways to do this here. So that's again, like we want to spur that public conversation and get people understanding that they do have a voice in this, right? I think sometimes people forget that your voice actually matters. We can have a positive outcome if we all speak up.
All right, that was the Little Petey River up there in North Carolina, South Carolina zone. Let's move on to the next one, number six. What do you have for us?
The Farmington River in Connecticut. So here we have a outdated hydropower dam. It's called the Rainbow Dam. It's on the Farmington River. It's been in operation for a long time, not in the greatest shape, but it is generating some power. And it also has some pretty big impacts on fisheries, and it contributes to these toxic algae outbreaks, which are really harmful. They can be really harmful to people and wildlife. The reason why this happens often behind dams is because like a dam blocks that water, it heats up. So you've got like the nutrients plus the heat, which creates the perfect conditions for this toxic algae to thrive. So we're really hoping that the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and the dam operator, the Farmington River Power Company, can address this harm, can address these threats, and bring this dam to meet reasonable standards for the health of the river and for the public.
This seems like more of the ongoing reality that the idea that hydropower is clean power is showing its true face, that it's not clean power, that it has incredible damaging effects. Sometimes they take a while to show up, but once they show up, they are really present.
Hydropower can have serious impacts. You're right. It's becoming more and more part of the conversation that the reservoirs behind a lot of dams are sources of methane, which is even more potent than carbon as a greenhouse gas. Like any energy source, we have to look at the costs and the benefits. And in some cases, it's going to make sense for a hydropower dam to stay in place. In a lot of other cases, it's not. And we need free-flowing rivers.
We do. Okay, so moving on to the next one is number seven. Tell us about this one.
So number seven is the Trinity River in California. The Trinity River is a tributary of the Klamath, where the world's biggest dam removal is underway. And the Trinity River is so important because it is a source of cold, clean water. And that's important for the Trinity River itself. And it's important for the Klamath, that whole system. If we want the Klamath River dam removal and restoration to be as successful as possible, we need that habitat. We need to make sure that the fish, the salmon swimming up the Klamath have places to go and have cold, clean water and have places to spawn. And so that's the Trinity. The tribes on the Trinity, the Hoopa tribe and others have been fighting for this river, have been advocating for this river. And the problem is that outdated water management, water diversions, and excessive water withdrawals that are threatening both salmon and people on the Trinity. So we need to protect the water in the Trinity River so that the river can be healthy and the whole Klamath system can be healthy.
This is interesting to me because last year I went to the Trinity to meet the teenagers who were doing the part of the Paddle Travel Waters program in Rios de Rivers who are learning to paddle so they can go down the Klamath when the dams come out. Awesome time. We spent a week together and I went boating with them on the Trinity and I found that river to be just amazing. Beautiful water. The swimming was just delicious and like just so good. And it makes a lot of sense that the support system that this provides for the Klamath as the Klamath gets a little messy as the dams come out. There's a mess coming down the river. And I think that was known that was going to happen. But the support system of cold, clean water coming in from its sister stream seems just so important. Number eight on the list looks like it's very far north. What do you have?
Number eight is the Kobuk River in Alaska. So this is just one of the most gorgeous wild rivers we have. So critical to the Inupiat people, the fish and wildlife here, the caribou. And the threat here, again, is road construction and how that road construction could lead to more mining development. So it's sort of like the slippery slope. If you build the road, then you have more mining. And then all of a sudden, you've got the pollution, you've got the impacts to wildlife, impacts to culture. And we need to just keep this place protected. This is just not the place. The people who depend on this river need this river to be clean, to be healthy. They need the wildlife there. They depend on the wildlife. So we need to not allow these permits to move forward for this road construction.
And we talk in the Southeast, talk about like the salamanders and the mussels. And up here, there's probably small critters, but this is still a land of big, big animals. Caribou,
charismatic
big bears,
megafauna, right?
Charismatic megafauna. Huh, I might be that for Halloween. Yes, but these big critters, I mean, you see these pictures in here are just awesome of these caribou swimming the river. Continuing on, number nine, this is, so introduce this river really quick, please.
And so number nine, number nine is the Tijuana River on the border, California and Mexico. And this is a river that is just incredibly threatened by pollution. And the public health story here is so stark. So the Tijuana flows into the Pacific Ocean. It used to be a place, the river and the beach there, of, you know, a place of swimming and families having fun. And, you know, it's a great surfing beach, great surfing community there. And because of the pollution in the river, now like contaminating the beach, it's a public health threat. People are getting sick. And this pollution like actually becomes aerosolized in the air too, which is just disgusting and unacceptable for anywhere, for any river, for any beach. It's just not okay. And we need infrastructure investment. We need to get a handle on this pollution so that people can have their river and their beach back. It's hurting local businesses. It's just, it's simply unacceptable and we need investment to clean it up.
And this is one where I'm going to have another interview with the people on the ground there, Ramon Charez from Un Mar de Colores. And also you all are working with Surfrider Foundation. This one is so interesting to me, which is why I'm super excited for the other interview because of the intersection, the interface, however you want to call it, the mouth of the river at the ocean and how the water cycle, the delivery happened. And so that'll be
absolutely
a, yeah. Number 10 on the list. Tell us.
Number 10, final river on the list, is the Blackwater in West Virginia. So I used to live in DC, in Washington, DC. And I remember, like, you always go out to the Blackwater River. It's such a recreational, like, hotspot for people in that whole zone, for hiking, for skiing, fishing, biking, like, just all the things. It's such a gorgeous, gorgeous spot. And this river and this landscape, like Canaan Valley, Blackwater Falls State Park, threatened by another highway development. So I mentioned that was one of the things we're seeing on this year's list. Again, we're not saying don't build any highway. We're saying there's an alternate route that makes a lot more sense if we want to protect the streams and wetlands that are so critical to the river and this ecosystem. So there's a good solution here.
Today's episode is sponsored by AED One Stop Shop. Are you a river guide or a river outfitter? Are you looking for AEDs at a good price? AED One Stop Shop has been a vendor member of the American Outdoors Association Conference for 10 years, supplying AEDs to river outfitters. AED One Stop Shop is providing a bulk order discount on their AED bundles right now, which includes the Heart Sign Samaritan AED, which is 2.4 pounds and the most tolerant to dust and water, some trauma shears, gloves, a shaving razor, and a protective carrying case for on-water transport. To gain this discount, use the link in the show notes on our website or in our Instagram link tree to hit the landing page for AED One Stop Shop.
Today's sponsor is Rocky Talkie. This is Sam. I'm on the river with these Rocky Talkie radios. I'm using the 5-watt. It is waterproof. And right now, I'm at a distance of 1+ miles down a river canyon from the recording device. We've been using them for 4 days, all day, and leaving them out in the cold at night, and we still have 95% battery. We have used these in blind rapids to communicate from the top to the bottom that things are good or that things aren't good. They've been really helpful for that. Rocky Talkie is offering a discount for you, the River Radius listener. The discount code is RiverRadius10, that's 10, RiverRadius10, 10% off your entire order. You can find their web address and discount code in our show notes.
From here, we will talk with our three local river guests. We start at the Tijuana River. The Tijuana River has headwaters in the desert mountains that straddle the Mexico and U.S. borders, where California meets Baja Norte, with the majority of the headwaters and the full river in Mexico. It is just the last 6 or 7 miles of the main stem river that has crossed into the United States on its way to the Pacific Ocean at that very southern end of California. The Tijuana River is 120 miles long, and on the way from those headwaters to the ocean, the river travels through the Mexican city of Tijuana. This is a desert river and does not flow year-round. The ocean communities at the Tijuana River estuary are home to ocean surfers and many other people who enjoy the river, the ocean, the estuary. Because migration patterns lead people to the city of Tijuana as they travel north, and often migrants get slowed and stopped at Tijuana in their migration, the population of Tijuana has grown significantly and the growth is somewhat unregulated. To learn more, I was able to talk with Ramon Chavez, a lifelong resident of Southern California who works for Un Mar de Colores, doing work to support the surf community and therefore the quality of the water in the Tijuana River and the ocean. Please meet Ramon Chavez.
My name is Ramon Chavez. So I work for Un Mar de Colores. I am the education coordinator. Our mission is to provide coastal access to marginalized communities. Our aim is BIPOC communities, but we're not limited to that. You know, we're open for all. And we provide environmental education, ecological stewardship, and we do it primarily through surfing. So we're in essence, we're trying to diversify the sport of surfing kind of on a recreational level. We're really starting to get connected to all of our watersheds. And this issue in particular was just a no-brainer for us because I grew up here. You know, I grew up in the Tijuana River Valley. And so, yeah, so that's what we do as an organization. And we have a lot of fun doing it.
And so you told me that you're right there at the estuary. You're right at the ocean where the river comes into the ocean. Tell us about the estuary. I mean, I think of estuaries as really beautiful places where there's this intersection of fresh water and salt water, and there's a kind of a cool collection of birds and aquatic species. So maybe start there, what it could be, and then tell us what it is today. What's going on there?
First of all, it's the last intact wetland in Southern California. You know, the estuary has somewhere around almost 400 species of birds coming and going, right? Migrating, laying eggs here. Our environment is endemic, right? We're a chaparral environment in general, like the larger watershed. It's part of a chaparral environment. Incredibly biodiverse with a lot of species of plants and animals that are endemic. The estuary itself is stunning. It hugs up against the border on one side, Mexico, the fence is there. And on the other side is South San Diego and the community of Imperial Beach, San Isidro, which is closer to the actual border crossing. And Imperial Beach is, you know, hugging the ocean, obviously. The estuary is a gem. I think it was, for me, really valuable. I grew up next to it. I grew up next to the river valley, playing in it, but I never really understood its role. And just learning how it functions, right? The filter function in terms of the salt water coming together with fresh water, river water, is amazing. And what happens there, right? And so all the different microorganisms that, you know, kind of engage in all these processes that we benefit from, right? So it's a pretty amazing space.
So you're a kid, like you're born of the estuary. Like you're one of these rare people in the world that really knows the intersection of the fresh and the salt water.
Well, it's funny because I was born in LA. My parents are Mexican immigrants, and I was the first in my family to be born here. When I was 14, our parents decided to move back to kind of the region where they grew up in Tijuana, and we ended up in South San Diego, right by the border. And so I had never really interacted with a natural space up until then. And that was a playground. You know, I went from playing on baseball fields and football fields to exploring the estuary, right, or the river valley. And so it's pretty magical. I had no idea at the time, none of us did, that we were being exposed to, you know, bacteria in that river valley. But, you know, it didn't matter to us. We were having fun.
Right. It's fun as kids. So then what's going on today? What is the challenge that's putting this pressure on the Tijuana River, on the estuary? This river is listed as number 9 on this list. What's going on that's creating these pretty serious problems?
It's super complex, but I'll just say that there's transboundary pollution and sewage coming across the border and entering into the river valley and then into the Tijuana River, and then the estuary, and then the ocean. In Imperial Beach, we've had over 800 days, consecutive days of beach closures. That's the county basically saying it's not safe to go in the water, right? And the city as well. And then for people, for the residential zones that are along the actual river valley leading up to the estuary, they're living next to an open sewer. There's raw sewage flowing through there along with all the different industrial pollutants and chemicals that come from an industrial manufacturing zone in Tijuana. So there's different zones in Tijuana that are doing a lot of manufacturing. These are a lot of them are American corporations, ironically, right? And because they don't have the same regulations here as we do in the United States, then they're able to do other things with some of their wastewater. And a lot of it is, it's in the river valley, it's in the estuary, it's in the ocean. So it's a super, to use a surfer slang, a super gnarly situation. It's clear that it's going to take both countries collaborating and working together to solve the issue. The main issue on the American side is that there's a treatment plant that's run by the International Boundary Water Commission, and it's been out of compliance for a while now, and it's not functioning, and it's suffered basically a couple of decades of neglect. It's a small federal agency that, you know, kind of oversees not just that plant, but other different projects along the border.
Just for clarity, that federal agency that's not, the plant is not able to keep up, that's on the U.S. side?
It's on the U.S. side.
Okay.
But they've been operating for the last couple of, at least the last decade, they've been operating on a shoestring to operate not just what they're overseeing and manage what they're overseeing, but primarily the plant. And so it's been severely underfunded. When it rains, when there's large storms, it cannot handle the capacity because there's a lot of tributary canyons that come through into the watershed from Tijuana, and they're carrying all kinds of funky stuff, right? Household chemicals, tires, trash, like I said, industrial waste. And so all that stuff is flowing naturally to into the river valley and through the river. And that on the sewage side, the plant just can't handle the capacity. Pretty new for us. We've always known that sewage has been coming through the river valley. We were only really concerned about it when it was raining heavily. If you were a surfer, you were staying out of the water the first week after a heavy rain, maybe 2 weeks, just depending on how heavy it was. But outside of that, you were enjoying the ocean. You were walking through the river valley. You were doing trail. It's all good. But we're not there anymore. It's definitely intensified.
I was doing some reading to understand. What I was reading was that there's just been immense growth in Tijuana in the past bunch of years, that more and more people are living there, and the city has not been able to keep up with this population increase.
Sure. The Mexican side, overpopulation there is definitely a factor. Tijuana gets something like 2,000 new people arriving every single day. This is a city that's relatively young in its existence, and it can't handle that kind of population capacity. They just don't have the infrastructure, right? So it's some people end up staying there. Some people, if they're lucky, they get to cross, and some people head back home. It's a really, I think it's in terms of what's happening globally with migration and people moving from places where there isn't work, where there's environmental justice issues, or really just feel threatened. Like in Latin America, it's in Central America where there's a lot of a lot of narco trafficking, danger. It's just people are moving, and this is where they kind of get stuck here at the border. So they end up in Tijuana, and Tijuana is kind of developed in canyons, where people couldn't find somewhere to live, they ended up creating these shanty towns along the canyons that end up, connected to our watershed and our river valley. Like I mentioned, these are canyons, right? These are tributary canyons. And so when it rains, everything's coming through. There are a lot of plastic, a lot of trash, tires. That's, this issue has been going on for decades, by the way. And so it's just kind of hitting a crazy climax that I don't think anybody really was ready for. But really what we're looking at right now is the public health crisis, right? There's a lot of funky bacteria and viruses in that water. The School of Public Health at San Diego State University with Dr. Granados, they've been doing work a long time in that river valley, and what they're finding there is just wasn't what they're finding all the normal things that you would find in raw sewage. It's just in greater numbers. That's what they weren't expecting. Different bacterias and pathogens and viruses and whatnot. On the industrial pollutant side, they've found all the different like heavy metals and toxins. That's what we're concerned about. We know it's a risk. That's not the question. It's more like, how do we address this issue? And so getting the federal government, recently they released, I think, $150 million to go towards the plant, right? But we're gonna need so much more, man. We're gonna need it 300, 400, $600 million, maybe $1 billion to really get at this issue so that we're not exposing our community to all these things in the water, but also in the air, and that our beaches aren't being closed, indefinitely. So there's another study that's being done by Dr. Kimberly Prather over at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and they're looking at aerosolized bacteria. And so it's there, and when it's in the water, when it's in the ocean, and there's strong winds and storms, it intensifies. The numbers go up versus if there's no wind or rain or powerful surf. So there's a lot going on, what's happening and what the studies that are being done and the efforts that are being led by, our local government of Imperial Beach, but also the regional leaders in Coronado, Chula Vista, San Isidro. Like we're all rallying around this issue so that we can get it fixed, man. And that's the thing. It's very preventable. It's fixable. We know what the estuary, what the river valley needs. And so we're calling on the Biden administration and members of Congress to support us and come through. So.
So that's the main push then. The solution that you all are looking for is is United States funding for this federal plant on the US side. I don't want to say like it's easy, that's the solution, but it's a fairly like reachable solution that you all understand. You can say, this is it. Okay. So is the pursuit of this money, this federal funding, is it to upgrade the plant or to fully get rid of it and get a new plant that can 100%?
No, it's to upgrade the plant. Their new commissioner is kind of leading the charge and doing some great work. And their goal is to really invest in the renovation, repairs, bringing the plant up to compliance, you know. So they're doing that, but there's other projects too, right? Some of the collaborative work that's being done with Mexico is to help them also on their side, right? And so there's a couple of pumps that are supposed to basically capture some of that raw sewage and industrial waste and then send it up to a plant on the Mexican side, right? But those two pumps have, you know, I think they're being repaired right now, but they basically broke down recently. And recently, I mean like 2 or 3 years ago. And then the pipelines that take that wastewater from the pumps to the actual plants, they're testing those too, because it, you know, they're repairing the pumps and then they're also trying to test the pressure levels and see if they can handle the volume and the distance. That work is underway. I think the plant is being repaired on the Mexican side as well. So there's a lot of promise and a lot of movement.
I'm curious then about the relationship, that cross-border relationship in terms of trying to work on this. And I understand that you're looking for federal money, U.S. money, to fix the pump on the U.S. side. But what is the relationship like between the people you work with on the U.S. side, the people on the Mexican side? How is that relationship going, working towards a solution?
Yeah. Well, let me say that the Mexican federal government, the plan is to invest $150 million over the course of the next 3 years. And that first $50 million has already been invested in these pumps and pipes and the plants in on the Mexican side. So I mention that because that's a big step forward. You know, money doesn't work the same way it does in Mexico as it does here in the United States. Like, dollars don't roll over. Like, you get what you get 1 year, and then that's what you get to operate with. And so the fact that they've already, you know, invested a third of the $150 million is a huge accomplishment. That's an effort that was led internationally by both countries, right? At least for now, we're seeing some progress. As one of our city council members said recently in a meeting, he said, things change with administration changes. Mm-hmm. So both countries are coming up on elections, and we're trying to get investment done before that potential change, right? Because we don't know what's going to happen after that on both sides of the border. So,
all right, Ramon, thank you so much. Have an awesome morning, and I'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Sam. Okay. Pleasure.
Up next, we are looking at one of the most diverse rivers on planet Earth, the Duck River in Tennessee. Please meet our guest, Grace Stranch in the Harpeth Conservancy.
My name is Grace Stranch.
And Grace, tell me where you work, the organization you work for, and the work you do.
Yeah, I'm the CEO of Harpeth Conservancy. Our vision is clean water and healthy ecosystems for rivers in Tennessee, championed by those who live here.
Awesome. And then we're here to talk about the Duck River, which, per the American Rivers Most Endangered Rivers list, they are number 3. Tell us about the Duck River, please.
Yeah, so the Duck River, if you're not from this area, you might not have heard of it, but it is the most aquatically biodiverse river in all of North America. It's number 3 in the world. It is the longest river in its entirety that's only within the state of Tennessee. It's mainly free-flowing, but it does have a dam on one portion of it, so it is not completely free-flowing.
Tell us about what's in it. What's going on in the water there that makes it so biodiverse?
We have tons of fish and mussels. I always like to give names of some of the mussels. Some of my favorites are the birdwing pearly mussel, Cumberland monkey face is another good example. We also have a ton of darters, the copper cheek darter, and a lot of aquatic snails as well. So we're trying to do our best to make mussels and snails and critters like this sexy, because when you think of endangered species, most people think of the polar bears, but we're trying to get people, hey, think about the mussels. Mussels are so important for the health of a river. They filter out an absurd amount of pollutants from the water. So we need these mussels to have good water quality. And so having such a plethora of mussels and snails and fish that all kind of intersect on our river just makes it a really incredible, unique place.
And this river, I feel like it's running, it's like a mix of kind of rural country, but also it does go through a couple of, I don't want to say big cities, but larger towns.
So it's majority rural, I would say, but it does go through like Shelbyville, Columbia, Centerville. And that goes to part of the issues that's surrounding it is that these are all areas of major growth. And because this is Middle Tennessee, for those who don't know, Nashville is in Middle Tennessee. So we're the capital. So we have one of the largest populations in Tennessee, or the one of the largest cities. And as our city's expanding, you're seeing all of the areas around it grow more and more as land is going up. When you look at Zillow prices, we're one of the top cities every year now for cost. And so that's pushing people out. And so we're kind of getting a blend of these smaller cities are getting a lot bigger, but also people are moving and want to live there because it's gorgeous. Tennessee is just a beautiful natural. We have like the most visited national park in the U.S. We have the most caves in the U.S. You know, most of our rivers, it's not just a duck. We just have extreme biodiversity. So, and about 93%, I think, is rural. So there's a lot of open land. If you're an outdoors person who really wants to be in nature, Tennessee is a great state to move to. The problem is we have limited space where people can move and grow. And so as our cities are growing, it's putting strains as they extend out. And one of those is in, unfortunately, the watershed of the duck.
And so how does that growth create problems for the duck?
So when you have growth, I always say when you want to build an area, what a lot of people don't think about is they'll say, oh, we'll just build right here. Well, you have to think about the water infrastructure and sewer infrastructure of where you want to build. And so does that area actually have adequate water to support building a community? And what we're seeing happening is that more and more developments are asking to develop there, and their rates for these utilities, their ratepayers are going up. They're getting more and more people who want to move there and newer developments. But the issue is for a lot of those areas, there is not enough water, or there's not sewage. You know, they're having to do these alternative systems for these communities. And so right now, a lot of these cities are at capacity. Their water utilities are hitting kind of the upper limits of what they can do with their current populations. And so when you have all of these new people moving here and they're already at capacity, then they need more water. And so where they're going to get that water from is the larger rivers. And the Duck River, it's actually not a huge river when you actually look down at it, but it is the largest river in this area. And so what has happened is these utilities are trying to expand their water withdrawal permits. And the environmental agency has put together kind of a pilot project to try to get them to work together and figure out limits that make sense so that they're protecting the duck. There's a lot of times of drought. And when there are times of drought, there's no water there and the mussels need that water. And so you lose that biodiversity if too much water is pulled from the duck. And so that's really what we're afraid is going to happen. And what we have seen happen in times of drought already, that's without considering the changes in climate and rain retention that we're thinking are going to happen in the next few years. So the recharge versus what's happening now, we're seeing a real issue with having enough water to protect that biodiversity.
Why is rain retention changing?
Because of climate change, EPA is projecting a 2.5 to 5% reduction in rainwater recharge for Tennessee's rivers in particular and groundwater. So that, you know, results in a huge loss for our recharge. So we have to take that into account. Mm-hmm. So not only are we pulling more water from the rivers, but now we're actually getting less water that's recharging our rivers. So we have to think about if we're getting fewer rainfalls or the quantity is less and we're pulling more water from the river, what does this mean, you know, for our biodiversity and mussels that need that water and in times of drought won't survive if there's not water there for them?
And do any of these urban areas, small towns, big towns, cities, have any restrictions on how water is used so that there's not like wasteful use of water?
Yeah, so one of the things that we really want to get out of this river is to get comprehensive plans in place with experts who actually know what is necessary, whether it's the scientific studies to know the actual like flow rates that are necessary for the rivers to maintain their quality. The other thing are zoning, and zoning is a huge issue. And as you get out further outside of the major cities that maybe don't have MS4s, that don't have other systems in place, what you will see a lot of times is fewer zoning rules. And so that's one of the issues that we would like to actually be studied to say, what zoning regulations do we need here or tweaks to make sure that this beautiful river that is water for all of these communities, and it's also for agriculture, and there's industry uses and recreation, like 150,000 plus people who recreate there, that we have enough water to serve all of these different needs.
So if you're looking for less water coming out, maybe some changes to zoning, how are you getting to that idea of less water coming out? Like what I feel like I read that there's a conversation with the governor and with the state
Yeah.
legislature.
What our hope is Governor Lee went on a conservation tour after he was elected with conservation priorities. So we know that he cares about conservation. It's one of his priorities of his campaign. And what we're hoping for is we want him to put together a technical task force. And we want this technical task force to be made up of experts who can work together and provide expertise and these recommendations regarding the water management and conservation. So that could be looking at the water loss rates. Like, hey, these permits can't have water loss rates of, 20%, 25%. They need to improve their system so that they're not losing the water that they're taking out. We need to look at the flow rates of the rivers to make sure that in times of drought that we have something in place. We need to do scientific studies. We need more information, drought management, so that we really can make sure that the permits that we're putting in place are adequately protective on TDEC's side. But we also want to make sure that we have the good zoning in place that makes sense for the river, and not just for the river, but the communities. I mean, there are thriving communities along this river that really rely on the duck, outdoor recreation, farmers. There's plenty of people that if the duck gets too low on water, it's going to have impacts not just on the biodiversity, but on the way of life of many of these community members. And then we really want him to direct TDEC, which is our environmental agency, to really develop a comprehensive plan to proactively manage the long-term and sustainable use of the Duck River. And so we're really glad that they did this pilot project. It just has not gone far enough based on some of the permits that have been issued recently. The ones we have seen, we feel are not adequately protective enough for the Duck River. And the way our permit cycles go, it's going to be 5 more years until the next round. We don't think the Duck River can handle waiting that long to have adequate protections put in place. And then to get this done, we really need him to fund scientific studies. And so we're asking, while he's making his budget for the year, will you put aside money to actually fund more work on the Duck River so that we can get these flow studies, so that we can make sure we have what we need to adequately protect the Duck River. We need the funding to be able to have these scientific studies so that our plans actually make sense, that they're predicated on facts of how we can best protect them.
All right, Grace Stranch and Harpeth Conservancy, thank you for taking the time to tell us about the Duck River. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Our last in-depth conversation today is closer to my home and is a place where the rivers course through unique plateaus, mountains, and desert country with a mix of ultra-deep canyons and huge sky views, New Mexico. Our guest is from Amigos Bravos. Please meet Rachel Kahn.
Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. I'm the deputy director of Amigos Bravos. Amigos Bravos is a statewide water conservation organization in New Mexico. We work to protect and restore the waters of New Mexico. We have staff in Albuquerque, and our main office is in the northern part of the state in Taos.
And your river, you all are the top concern on the list from American Rivers, number one listing. And it's not just one river, it's the entire state of New Mexico and all the rivers of your state, which I would actually assume means rivers and smaller creeks, streams. Before we get into why, would you describe the riverscape, the landscape, and even the climate of New Mexico?
So we're a high desert state. We're very arid. We have the Rio Grande. It flows right down the middle of the state. That's our state's largest river. We have a couple other larger river systems, the Pecos, the San Juan, and the Gila. When we say large river systems in New Mexico, it's good to keep in mind that even the Rio Grande at times dries up right in the middle section in the middle of summer. And you can pretty much wade across most sections of the river. When we talk about large, it's a different scale than perhaps in other parts of the country. And then we have lots of little drainages that feed into our larger rivers that many of those don't flow year round. They flow in response to snow melt and rain, or when the water table is a little bit higher, that's when they flow. So as a state, we have limited water resources.
And when you say that there are times when the Rio Grande dries up in the middle of the state, my thought is that it's drying up not because of a lack of water, but it's drying up because of a lot of extraction from the river. Maybe a combination of lower water season, but also extraction.
Yes, it's a combination of, even before we were diverting water off of the Rio Grande, that these systems were in an arid climate. They were never as large as, say, like the Hudson River or the Mississippi River, which is just a different scale of river here in the state. And then we have all the diversions. And then also now we also have climate change and increased temperatures, which is causing more evapotranspiration of the water and so less water.
So, American Rivers and their most endangered rivers list, they put the rivers of New Mexico as the number one river system on this list. What's going on? What is this threat that New Mexico rivers are facing?
So, with the recent US Supreme Court decision from May of 2023, combined with previous US Supreme Court decisions back in 2005, 2006 time period, most of New Mexico's waters are now no longer federally protected by the Clean Water Act. So, there's been this drastic reduction of federal Clean Water Act protections across the nation. But here in New Mexico, we have up to 96% of our rivers and streams are threatened or no longer protected with that federal landmark piece of legislation, the Clean Water Act, which has been so critical across the country for cleaning up our waters and keeping those waters clean. And now we no longer have that tool protecting New Mexico's waters. Also, our wetlands, up to 88% of our wetlands are no longer protected in the state by the Federal Clean Water Act. On top of that, New Mexico is one of only three states in the country without a state-level surface water permitting program. So many other states have state-level programs that control pollution, the discharge of pollution into their state waters. Here in New Mexico, we don't have that. And that makes us, combined with the fact that we're an arid state and the Supreme Court, the US Supreme Court decisions disproportionately are stripping protections from smaller waterways like the ones we have here in New Mexico. So we have so many of those smaller waterways that don't flow year round or have limited flow, and we don't have this state program in place. So the combination of those two factors puts our waters at extreme risk of pollution.
And what are the sources of pollution that New Mexico waterways are dealing with?
A lot of our waterways are threatened by things like dumping of chemicals, sewage, and other pollutants from industries and businesses. We're worried about streams being obstructed by infill, so dirt and gravel being pushed into rivers and clogging up rivers. That's another threat, rivers and wetlands. There's the threat of runoff of pollution from mines, from built-up areas, from cities. That's actually a large source of pollution, is the runoff that comes off of roads and highways, carries a lot of heavy metals. Stormwater runoff is a big source of pollution, and it's not just city areas, but industrial areas with stormwater runoff from industrial areas. Los Alamos National Laboratory sits up on a plateau that looks down over the Rio Grande. And many of those drainages that flow through Los Alamos National Laboratory, that was, everyone's maybe more familiar with that now after the Oppenheimer movie this past year. So it's that facility there. Lots of the drainages there in that landscape are small, are ephemeral, intermittent, which means that they don't necessarily flow year round. And those are the types of waters that have lost protections. And there's a lot of stormwater runoff that comes off the Los Alamos National Laboratory on historic dumping sites back from the era of the Manhattan Project, and flow into these smaller drainages that make their way down to the Rio Grande itself.
So prior to the removal of the protections from the Clean Water Act, was, for instance, the Los Alamos Laboratory, were they doing other work to protect the streams in a way that's now different? Are they changing their habits now that the Supreme Court has reduced the reach of the Clean Water Act?
In a lot of cases, it's yet to be seen the full impact of the recent Supreme Court decision. And that's because it takes a while for things to catch up. We have these permits that are issued by EPA here in New Mexico under the Clean Water Act, under the previous, before the Supreme Court decision, when all the waters were protected. So these permits have been issued. They're issued at 5-year permit increments. And so they're in place. And so where it comes a question is either you have a permittee that advocates to have those permits be discontinued, or at the end of that 5-year period, there's a renewal process. And that's typically the period of time when EPA will say you no longer need a permit. So we're in this 5-year waiting period to see permits get discontinued.
So in lieu of protections from the Clean Water Act that were stripped in 2023, what are you all, what is Amigos Bravos looking at for solutions for methods to protect? I mean, it sounds like almost all the streams in the state. You said 96% of the streams, that's a lot. What are you all looking to do to take care of the streams and the rivers?
So we've been working with partners to advocate for state level protections to fill that gap left by the loss of federal protections. And we've been very lucky that our state legislature and our governor, Governor Lujan Grisham, has, in our most recent legislative session, passed $7.6 million of funding for developing a state program, a state surface water permitting program, to provide those safeguards that were lost now that EPA can no longer issue permits for many of the waters in the state. And so we're excited to see that state leadership, but we're at the beginning of the process, and we're really wanting that process to move quickly so that we can get those state protections in place as soon as possible.
Rachel Kahn, Amigos Bravos, thank you for coming on the mic and telling us about rivers in New Mexico.
Thank you so much for having me.
To bring this episode into closure, we get back to the conversation with Amy Sowers-Kober of American Rivers, where she is expressing how this most endangered rivers list has created river success stories in the past years.
And this report, I mean, I think I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, but it really does have a track record of success. I mean, the Boundary Waters in Minnesota was on this list for multiple years because of mining threats. And, you know, I'm not claiming all the credit here. I'm not, just because it's on our list, magic happens. But it really, this report, this campaign helped shine the spotlight. So in collaboration with local partners, it really can help make a difference. On the Rappahannock River in Virginia, on the Buffalo National River in Arkansas, on the Eel River in California, all those rivers like were past most endangered rivers, and they've had good things happen because of all the work of our partners and because of the visibility of this campaign. So my hope is that it really can make a difference for a lot of the rivers, all of the rivers on this year's list, and we'll see some positive outcomes.
Awesome. Amy Sowers-Kober, American Rivers, thanks for coming on, telling us this story, and we'll talk to you again next year.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Sam.
An estuary-sized thank you goes out to all of our guests today. You can learn more about this list from American Rivers in our show notes, where we have all of their links. Additionally, we have links for all of our guests: Amigos Bravos from New Mexico, Harpeth Conservancy from Tennessee, and Un Mar de Colores from California. Our sponsors today are Rocky Talkies and AED One Stop Shop. Rocky Talkie is offering River Radius listeners a discount on their products. Use the promo code RIVERRADIUS for 10% off your entire order. And AED One Stop Shop is providing volume and outfitter discounts on AEDs. Use the link in the show notes and on the sponsor page of our website. All River Radius social media is supported by Samantha Seiss. All River Radius music comes from the lap steel guitar of Gene Reiniger. Be in touch anytime. Hello at theriverradius.com. Thanks so much for joining the River Radius.
Charismatic megafauna.
Copper-cheeked darter.
Tennessee heel splitter.
Cumberland monkey face.
Bird wing pearly something.
The bird wing pearly muscle.
It's a super, to use a surfer slang, a super gnarly situation.